Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Strong Source Podcast. Today, we have an amazing guest. I think he's now sitting in London, so we're all doing it remote this time. And in this case, we have Willem Uijen as our guest. Willem is the Chief Procurement Officer from Unilever. It's our actually first CPO that we speak, so we spoke a lot with trading about commodities. And now we have somebody actually at the C-level of one of the biggest FMCGs in the world. So I'm super excited about this one, how Willem, how you look at commodities. How is the world from your point of view as a CPO? Because probably that is much more than just commodities, and topics like sustainability will probably be one of your key elements. So I'm very thrilled that you're here. We've seen each other already a few times, and super that you're here and spend the time with us and sharing some of your experiences in this amazing world.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Willem. Thanks for inviting me, Alex.
And maybe it's great to first start with a short intro from your side so the listeners have a bit of an idea.
Yeah, so it's great to be here today. And again, thanks for the invitation. So yes, you're right. I've been working with Unilever for 25 years. First of all, happily married. I got three daughters that were all born in Mexico. Did quite a long stint there, actually, of about 12 years that I worked for Unilever in Mexico. Majority of my career in the supply chain. So different roles in manufacturing or distribution, planning, leading the supply chain for some of the markets in Latin America, Mexico specifically. I've worked in Asia as well for our business in Hindustan Unilever in India for the 3 years before my current role, and now procurement in Unilever. So I'm having a lot of fun.
Thanks for that intro. Well, Martijn, let me ask the first question and we dive into all this. Well, you know, as one of the largest FMCGs in the world, I mean, you have exposure to all kinds of commodities, right? So from probably from packaging to energy to the dairy side, sugars, food, etc. How do you look at commodities from your point of view as a CPO?
Yeah, so the large part of what we buy, so if you take Unilever as a whole, Unilever is a business that has sales globally of about 60 billion annually. Total spend that procurement manages here within Unilever is about 40 billion. You have a part of that that is indirects, you know, everything that we have in our marketing services and IT. But the direct materials that we have, so if that is packaging materials or the raw materials that we have, is a large part of that. And if you would dive into the packaging materials and our raw materials, a large part, over half of that, is directly commodity linked. That is indeed, as you mentioned, energy is a big part of that. But Unilever also, because of its portfolio, large in surfactants, there is an exposure that we have to palm. And I'm sure that we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. Materials such as aluminium, of course, in foods, there's sugar, cocoa, dairy. How we look at commodities, if I look at it from a procurement point of view, there is, of course, the supply security that we need to take care of. But mainly in commodities, I think the focus providing price stability to the business, as well as an advantage over the market that allows us to invest back behind our brands, is what we're focusing on.
Now, that's already a couple of really interesting comments you made, huh? Because you say stability of production is what you said, right? So you need to be aware that the factories run 24/7. Mm-hmm. So you may have a certain idea about prices, but okay, at the end of the day, you need to make sure that these factories are running, right? One of the things we are interested in, and I'm certainly our audience, is how the procurement organization, how that is actually organized and how it is organized globally and how it interacts with sales and with marketing and production. I can imagine that there are some different interests from, for example, a marketing function that wants to do a promotion on a certain product, whereby the procurement organization says, well, this doesn't make any sense because the product isn't available or it has a negative impact on margins. So can you give us an idea how you organize that and how the collaboration works?
Yeah. So the Unilever business is organized in five business groups. So we have beauty and well-being, personal care, home care, nutrition, and ice cream. And these business groups, they have the end-to-end P&L responsibility for that whole business globally. Now, what each of these business groups have is that they have then business units that do the execution of their business in each of the geographies. So you have a business unit, for example, for ice cream in Europe. You would have a business unit for home care in Latin America, for example. How we have organized procurement is that for all of the business groups, we have a CPO for that business group in place. And that is because there are materials that are very specific for each of those business groups. But also the agenda for procurement, if that is focused on, for example, specific sustainability topics, or if that is on specific partnerships that we have for developing innovations, or if that goes towards the work on resilience to ensure that the service is there, not only for the factories, but also on the customer and consumer side. These programs or these strategies are very much defined at a business group level, and therefore also the needs are very different for each of those business groups from procurement. So first of all, then, a CPO for each of the five business groups. But as Unilever, we also want to make sure that we make best possible use of the skills that we have. So some of the portfolios that we have of the materials or the services that we buy are going across those business groups and are managed globally as a portfolio. Now, that is, for example, for logistics, we have an organization in place that is called Customer Operations that does everything from planning and logistics. And the buyers that we have, or the buying team that we have for logistics, sits with that team to make sure that the lines are really short and that we do the right thing strategically as well for logistics. We have a portfolio there for materials that includes palm, for example, or includes fragrances. And there very much, because if you look at it for palm or for liquid oils, it makes sense to do the buying for that for all of the business groups together instead of different strategies for each business group. We have a portfolio that goes across as well for marketing and business services, which is all of the indirect spend, the marketing spends and the IT spends. And then we have a function that goes across as well, which is CRM, commodity risk management. Everything else is being managed directly by each of the business groups.
That CRM, and what really interests me is the visibility that you have as a CPO of the commodity exposure. In trading businesses, you would have all kinds of risk metrics. You would have something like value at risk, or you would have DVAR on trading desks, split in very specific risks. What is the type of exposure that you see? Because if you, we talked about some of the commodities that Unilever is exposed to, mention cocoa or palm. What kind of report, or maybe what dashboard do you see? And how does that impact your decisions or the instructions that you may give to those individual CPOs?
Well, I can imagine that the cocoa would be very steel up last year, so that would be
be one of those. But if you look at what happened over the last couple of years and with some of the commodities, like in aluminium, for example, or in palm itself, the kind of volatility that we have seen there, or soda ash, for example, we've gone through quite a few of those. But to your question of what I see, yes, we also look at the value that we have at risk. But the first thing that we in CRM look at is that all of our businesses have what we call a pricing horizon. It's basically the time that it takes to move prices through in the market. And we want to make sure at least covered for that period to offer the stability to the business for managing the P&L for that period. But the CRM function is also looking at what are specific opportunities to go further out than just the pricing horizon. And there, the value at risk, the coverage that we have, and what is the total coverage versus the consumption that we have is a few of the indicators that that I look at. We actually do that, or I do that myself on a weekly basis. Just before this call, for example, we have the CRM call where we look at what's happening in the market, take a look at the top commodities that we have and the specific strategies that are there, and then the decisions that are being taken or approved for the covers.
Yeah, interesting. One of the critical elements is how do you get information? So in large commodity trading houses, you have these huge research departments. They are critical. Now, as we said in the pre-discussion for the call, Unilever was my very first client when I started in Cargill on the vegetable oil trading desk. And we had a hotline. Unilever called and everything stopped. I'm not kidding. When Unilever called, everything stopped. And it was, guys, Unilever on the phone. And Unilever was one of the most important customers for our vegetable oil business. Our job was also to inform Unilever. And so at the time, and I don't know to what extent that is today, but obviously the margarine business has been sold. So on that sense, there may not be interaction anymore. But how do you get your information? So does Unilever have their own proprietary research department and commodity analysts, weather analysts, or do you depend to a large extent on external reports and on the advice of your suppliers? And you yourself, what type of analysis do you do as a CBA?
I think, Martijn, it's a bit of all, I have to say. So yes, we have our own analyst in Unilever. So the CRM function has a team in place that is specifically focused on the analysis of the market of specific commodities. So that's really split up for people that are dedicated to a group of commodities. So they do their own analysis. But if I would compare that with a trading desk that you were referring to in Cargill, for example, it's of a very different size. It's smaller than that. So the information that we also get from our partners, like with Cargill, as you mentioned before, or with other partners where we work closely on some of the materials that we buy that are commodity related, we do get information from that. And then there's third parties as well that we use for specific market insights. So I think the combination of those three would cover the majority of it.
You have so many of these. What I found so interesting is from your role, right? So you have a CBA, and you said already like all these different industries, is the exposure that you have, so home care, personal care, you got food, you got basically all on a day-to-day, on a weekly basis, is like touch upon all of them every week or something like that? Or is it like, no, I go to the ones that are on fire or that really need that moment of help from me or an extra eye, pair of eyes? How does that basically work?
What we do pay a lot of attention to is what is the strategy that we have for a specific commodity. Once that strategy is defined, so that gets extensively discussed, then the execution for that doesn't change that often unless market conditions change completely. So yes, you do have commodities like, for example, with cocoa this year, that you would review that strategy more often and see what kind of adjustments you would make. But when things are more stable, if I look at palm prices, for example, for the last year or 2 years or so, when that is more stable, the strategy would be in place, would be agreed in the forums that we have for that commodity risk management. And then the execution of that gets reviewed still on a weekly basis, but there is much less discussion on that. So all of the commodities that we have a larger exposure to, I do look at it weekly. People that I mentioned before, of course, are doing this on a daily basis. But the more detailed discussion are really on either where we believe that it's worth to take another look at strategy that we have for the specific commodity, or specific market conditions are requiring us to review it in more detail. So it's more exception-based, I would say, than all of the commodities every week fully through.
Could you share with us how you experienced the transition from being in supply chain for such a long time? Because you're 25 years with Unilever, but I think 23-ish years in supply chain. And then you move to a CPO role. Now, supply chain is volatile. Yeah, you need to be extremely adaptable. But it's a different thing when you see the exposure. And especially, we mentioned a couple of commodities, cocoa, but also energy, and since the Ukraine was invaded by Russia. How do you experience this transition from all those years in supply chain and now doing the procurement?
Yeah, first of all, I'm enjoying it a lot, the last 2 years here in procurement. I always, in supply chain, and especially for the last roles that I did, before the job that I was talking about in Asia, in Hindustan Unilever, I worked several years for the home care category. Now, the home care category, if you look at the commodity exposure of that category, if that is in crude or if that is in soda ash or some of the specific materials that are used in the formulations in home care, it very much depends on what happens in the commodity markets and is very dependent as well on procurement. So the supply chain function there is very integrated with the procurement function to make sure that not just for keeping the factories running that you were already mentioning before, and that's of course a big part of the job, but in supply chain there as well, landing innovations, the work that happens on the sustainability programs that we have, or specifically on the competitive buying or formulation changes to work on the superiority of our products. is all of that requires a very close integration with procurement. So that work was always very integrated, I feel, in the home care category. And also in the last couple of years in India, the home care business is a very large business there. But also the role that procurement plays in the business in India made it something that it's directly part of the supply chain leadership team, for example, that I was managing there. You can't really manage the supply chain, or you can't really run the supply chain if you don't work very closely with procurement. But of course, running procurement is different from working directly with procurement. So that is what I have been doing over the last 2 years. It made it very exciting. I'm enjoying it a lot, but I'm sure that we're going to talk more about that as well.
But if you look at now, for example, I see, for example, in China that they become more, actually less reliant on people on other commodities, basically. They want to do more of themselves. Either they buy sort of plots in countries or they just, like dairy, for example, start to make their own powders and stuff like that. Now, you've been in India, right? So how do you look at this from an India? Because they are massive regions for import a lot. They import massive volumes, they're super important. It could really change the dynamics, right? Now, I was wondering, do you see, and you've some experience in India, do you see that India as a country that they are changing more to self-reliant, different view on commodities that could perhaps change the dynamic of the commodity trading business?
Yeah. In India, the largest import that there is in India at a national level is crude. But the second largest import in India is liquid oils. Palm oil, actually, specifically. And there you see as well that with the development of industry, the strategy that the government has set out in India, look at ways to have more palm production in India directly. So you do see that type of development for the step up of industry and local production in a market like India. And for the commodities or for the materials, I would say, not just for commodities, but for the materials where we participate, it helps usually as well to have that more local production. And not just from a cost point of view, but it also helps from a resilience and agility point of view. The supply lines become shorter and you have more options for sourcing locations. So it helps in the resilience as well of your network to make sure that, well, coming back again, making sure that your products are available on the shelf at any point in time.
To zoom in on cocoa, Unilever has the ice cream business. Their cocoa powder is used and chocolate for coatings. Can you share with us a bit on how it was pretty much unprecedented what happened this season, how that landed on your desk?
Yeah.
Was it kind of slowly but surely filtering or going through the grapevine that something was happening in the cocoa market? Or was it a sudden escalation? Could you, because that is obviously an exciting case of what happens when a specific commodity, when there is an issue, and how does it land with the CPO, and then what happens in the organization?
Yeah, cocoa is a great example for that. I think if you look at the commodities that I mentioned before, if you look at the years before, the 3 years before, we have seen similar cycles with other commodities as well. We've seen something similar happening. Aluminium, for example. You have PKO, palm kernel oil, for example, that had a very similar type of cycle. We've seen it with, energy as well, gas in Europe, for example.
Yeah.
So yes, there is, of course, if you look at the volatility that we've seen for cocoa in the last year or so, it is of that similar level as we've seen with commodities before. So that helped us as well in having the experience from the previous cycles that we've seen in other commodities to be better prepared as well for what happened in cocoa. But every commodity crisis or every commodity volatility is different. No? So in the case of cocoa, it has been very stable at about, 2,500 pounds or so for a very long time. No? Multiple years, quite stable at that level. And we started seeing it to rise, of course, in the back end of last year. Now, the initial thinking, because the same way, the internal research that we have, but also the talks that we have with our partners that are large in cocoa, Cargill would be one of them, but you also have partners like Barry Callebaut, for example. That connect really helps as well to understand what the thinking is of others in what's happening in the cocoa market. And then the external research that we had. I do think that if you look at cocoa for the type of crisis that it has been in terms of the volatility in prices, the initial thinking was that it wouldn't go as high as it finally got to. and not just from ourselves, but also from the external research and the partners that we had. So there, I think it's, again, for a business like ours, it's very important to provide that price stability to be sure that you can manage the P&L. That kind of volatility that you would have if you would be fully exposed to a market like that on a very short-term basis becomes extremely difficult to manage with the type of portfolio that we have, the kind of products that we sell.
So basically, price cover in terms of months of usage covered in raw materials, and that is an important driver for you guys, right? Whereby you say you want to have a minimum 6 months, maybe in a certain commodity, you say I want to have minimum 9 months price covered. That is the type of vocabulary that you would use, right?
Correct.
Yeah. On the people doing that work, so when you think about Unilever, well, let me speak for myself, you think about marketing. I've always thought about, Unilever is of course a producer of consumer goods. But I think in the perception of a lot of people, marketing, and especially students who are looking for a job, they think about Unilever as a marketing company, one of the best marketing companies in the world, famous brands. How do you make sure that you also attract the best talent, the best and the brightest talent in supply chain and in procurement? So that people who would consider working in a commodities business, but in commodities trading, how do you attract them to Unilever?
Yeah, marketing is extremely important, of course, for any fast-moving consumer goods company. But if you, that undeniably, I get why you say Unilever, first thing I think of is marketing. Also, with all of the advertisement that you would see going through on the web or on television or whatever you would be watching. So I understand that. But if you look at Unilever supply chain wise, I would say it's a very attractive company as well. If you look at the scale that Unilever has of its supply chain, the breadth that and the depth that it has of its network with, if you look at it breadth-wise, with the number of factories that we have globally and that number of markets where we operate, makes it a very interesting supply chain. If you look at the materials or services that we buy, makes up two-thirds of the total P&L of Unilever. So that makes it also, in terms of the diversity of the portfolio and the scale of the spend that sits there, an attractive company for procurement to work in. And I think that is also there, not just because of the culture of the company and what the company stands for. I do believe that that makes a really big difference, by the way. So Unilever, with its purpose to make sustainable living commonplace, is also a big driver for many people in supply chain to join Unilever. And the reason for that, and supply chain, I take that a little bit broader, that it's procurement and our factories and distribution altogether. If I focus that a little bit more on procurement specifically, then you see that the main goals that we have set out for sustainability, a large part of these depend very much on procurement. Because if you want to reduce greenhouse gases, for example, emissions in your value chain, you take a look at where the emissions actually sit in the value chain, then a majority of that, close to 70%, actually comes from the materials and services that we buy. So that work needs to happen through procurement and the relationships that we have with our partners. The same goes very much for plastics, for example, and the transition there. The development of new supply chains, new partners can help us with the supply of, let's say, recycled plastic, for example, or alternative materials is something that for a large part sits on the plate of procurement. And the same goes for the social programs that we have with the smallholder farmers that we work with, or with the nature programs that are there for regenerative agriculture, for example, or the protection of natural ecosystems. Each of those depend very much on the relationships and the programs that we have in place with our suppliers. So sustainability, I think, is one element there. But also, if you look at the role that procurement plays in our company in innovation, so to drive growth and drive our innovation agenda, there is a very significant role to play there. Because if I go back 25 years ago when I joined the company, I think a large part of the innovations that we had in Unilever were developed in-house. You see more and more and more as well that great ideas and great innovations are coming from our partner network. And that might be the development of new materials that offer superiority for our products, or that might be in the full development of products as you have that with some of our partners in beauty and well-being, for example. So there again, the partnership frameworks that we have for how to bring in some of our suppliers much closer into the value chain of Unilever for the development of those innovations becomes really important. I think the same for, we spoke a little bit about agility and resilience. If you look at the portfolio that we have and the volatility that you have as well, because of, you mentioned promotions before, but natural volatility as well that we have in the market because of everything else that happens with competition as well, you see that the importance that is there of agility, being able to supply the market despite the volatility that's in place, is very important. The same goes for resilience, because you mentioned the COVID period, for example, before, or some of the commodity crisis that we have seen, to make sure that you can continue to supply the network with products that our customers and our consumers are looking for, becomes an important part. So actually, I think the agenda that we have in procurement for the type and the scale of company that we are is a very attractive agenda, because it's not just about the competitive buying, of course, and the contracting and the sourcing that sits there, but really how you drive growth in the company through innovation, work on that agility and resilience to make the supply chain more responsive every time. The work that happens on sustainability besides that hardcore sourcing makes it a very attractive function.
Yeah, so what I would love to touch upon is a lot of commodity people are now talking about sustainability EDR, right? So I think that's a massive topic. There's a lot of insecurities about it, unknowns about it, where it's going to lead to, what the implications will be. People in this world of commodities, for example, in oils and fats, I hear a lot of people complaining about the European government that they put in rules, compliance in place without consulting basically real industry experts. So I just wanted to have your view from the helicopter view, and you're globally, you have of course also the impact a lot from these implications from the governments on all continents. So just wondering, what is your view on this? And maybe personal / Unilever, right?
I think every big change, and I think what the DR is putting in place, is a very significant change for many industries of the products that are coming into the EU. And every one of those larger changes, they're never easy. Now, so I get some of the comments that you made. I do think that the consultation with industry and with the larger players for the different materials or different commodities is actually taking place. But it is an evolving topic. And as it is such a significant change, I do believe that it's always difficult to have it implemented. I think what helps us, if I look at it specifically for Unilever, very much in this case, is that the work that we have done on no deforestation over quite a number of years, but have stepped up that work as well as part of the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan that we launched in 2010. Or now as well, if you look at the sustainability goals that Unilever has set out, you clearly see no deforestation coming in there for the key commodities or the key crops that we buy. So that work for, let me pick a commodity in, for example, palm, is work that we have been doing for several decades now. And that has evolved over time into a system where we can now trace back the palm that we buy from the farmers to the mills and ensure that all of that palm oil or the palm kernel oil is sourced deforestation free. And the use of technology, I think, there with, for example, the use of geolocations has really helped to manage such a complex supply chain, because much of what is produced in palm, for example, as well as for other commodities, but to keep it with palm, actually depends on smallholder farmers in Indonesia or in Malaysia. So having that supply chain controlled in terms of ensuring that no deforestation is taking place, that really requires a robust system or robust technology to be in place to continue to monitor that. Now, I think the work that we have done there over the years that has been part of what we called out in our sustainability plan has really helped us to prepare for what's coming with EUDR.
Linked to that is a cost. And in general, sustainability, and you read a lot of online about the question, who's going to pay for this? And and I have always said, look, at the end of the day, everyone in the supply chain is going to fight for their margin. So at the end of the day, the consumer is going to pay for that. Now, we are in a highly inflationary environment since COVID. And I follow it mostly for the US because there it has a huge impact on financial markets. And compound inflation is, since COVID started, to 22.5%. Now, what I'm very interested in, and where you see a lot of debate, is the impact on commodity prices on the demand side. Now, the focus is usually in commodities on the supply side. But the last couple of years, there has been more attention for, okay, what is the impact of higher prices of food and energy on the consumer? And what is also the impact on the economy? Because at the end of the day, the consumer needs to make some tough choices about how they spend their money. Now, obviously, wages have increased as well. Fine. But what I'm interested in is how actually does it work between the FMCGs and the retailer? My experience is from the commodity processor to the FMCG. Now, I have heard all kinds of mythical stories about diehard negotiations between the FMCGs and the retailers. Could you explain to us how that actually works? And especially also the threats of products no longer on the shelves or being replaced by private label, long-term contracts. And sometimes I even heard that either the retailer or the FMCG companies would accept, for example, loss-making a chocolate category simply because the retailer said, look, the final consumer is expecting that on the shelf, so we'll keep it there, and you need to make money on something else. So this whole tense relationship, if you will, between the FMCGs and the retailers in a highly, in the last couple of years, inflationary environment, could you enlighten us how that works?
Yeah. Inflation, and especially the higher levels that we've seen over the last years in commodity prices, but also in labor costs, you mentioned that as well. We at the scale that we have seen that for the last three and a half years or so, we haven't seen that for a very long time. You go back to the decade before that, and if you take it at a global level, it has been much more stable. So again, with that level of volatility, it's never easy to manage, you know? If I start with, because you started off with sustainability and it has a cost to it, I think there are definitely cost elements in sustainability, undeniably. So if we implement the no deforestation programs, for example, for crops like palm or cocoa, that does require an investment. You also see that sustainability has, in other materials or services that we buy, a positive effect on the cost base. So if you look, for example, the transition that we have in renewable energy, electricity, for example, you can do that very competitively versus the non-renewable variants. You see as well that through formulation changes or alternative materials, if you compare, for example, natural to a synthetic soda ash, you definitely see a difference there in the greenhouse gas footprint, but also in the cost base. This is something that can play out positively. So I think it's definitely a mix between the two, but there are certain elements in sustainability that do require an investment. I think to your question on the retailers, of course, every retailer is looking to offer the best possible prices to their customers, the consumers in the end. I think what you clearly see with the retailers as well is that the understanding that is there of what happens in commodity markets or what happens with inflation is very strong. So also because of their own brands, or the private label brands, and the knowledge that they have because of that on what goes into formulations and what are the cost implications for that and what is the volatility in prices to see for those materials is very strong. So that makes as well that with the work that we do, for example, in procurement as Unilever, to make sure that our sales teams understand well what's happening in the commodity markets and what's driving, if there is a cost increase or if there is a cost decrease, what's driving that within our products, that makes that they're much better equipped as well to have those discussions with our customers. But I think the combination of those two, with the understanding that's there with the customers of what is happening with materials and what's happening in our markets because of their own private labels, is really helping with our sales team to have the proper discussions on this.
Alex, you had a question? Or you were still thinking about one?
No, I had a question. So, Willem, more as a CPO, right? So I was like, you do so much in your role on all kind of topics. So I was just wondering, do you like working about the commodities, or is commodities more like, you know, what's the fun part in all the things that you do? Because you probably have like hundreds of different things. And what do you think as a CPO of commodities, right? So I'm always, because it's one of your pillars, right? It's not all the pillars. So I was just wondering, is it something that people should work in? Should people dive into this world
of
commodities?
I think absolutely, yes. And the thing is, the industry that I work in, with of the materials that we procure, over 50% of that directly on commodities, you don't have the luxury to ignore it. You cannot. I think what we have done in Unilever over the last couple of years, we used to have, for example, our CRM function as part of one of the buying teams. So we had a buying team in place that was for Asia and was also doing commodity risk management for the whole of Unilever globally. What I put in place about a year and a half ago is to make that commodity risk management fully standalone and upgrade the talent that we have in commodity risk management as well. So we have a new head in place for commodity risk management. He has put in place several new resources or new people that we have, new talents into the team to up our game in commodity risk management. And look as well at what can we do to expand the capabilities and the coverage that we have for commodity risk management for the whole of Unilever. And ultimately, there with the goal to help the business with that price stability and advantage that we can have as well over the market. And I think because of the sheer scale that we have, if you sum up all of these commodities that we spoke about earlier, it's something that in a company like ours, you just can't ignore. So it needs to be part of your agenda, Alex, no doubt.
So do you think then that you upgraded the talent, you made a standalone? So does that mean that you say that it actually becomes more difficult, the world of commodities, for companies to manage, basically? Is that what you say, with other words?
Or besides the importance? The level of volatility that we've seen over the last couple of years is something that for a very long time we haven't seen. So, and I do expect as well that level of volatility that we've seen over the last couple of years is something that most likely in the years to come will still be there. Hard to predict in which of the commodities that will be, but as we spoke about earlier, we've seen it now moving in cycles basically between the different commodity classes that we have. So managing that volatility is something that won't go away for the years to come. So I do see that, Alex, but not something for just today, because we will need this as a capability for...
Then would you agree with the following sentences, that the producers and buyers want more transparency and less volatility? Would you agree with that sentence?
Not necessarily. So there's positives and negatives to it. If you look at the producers with the level of volatility that we've seen over the last couple of years, for some of the producers that has played out quite nicely. For others, more difficult. But so it's a bit of a mix there, Alex. I think for the buyers, if I look at it from my perspective in FMCG, the volatility is something that is not easy to manage. We spoke about the price effect that you would have because of it, and the difficulty that is there as well, of course, with consumer wallets for it. But also you see that with that high level of volatility, it's the companies that are able to manage that well that come out better of a period of high level of volatility compared to some others. So there's pluses and minuses to it.
And regarding the transparency?
Transparency, absolutely. I do believe that transparency overall in the supply chain, not just in commodities, but on anything else that we have in the value chain, if that goes from the sourcing of the materials and the feedstocks that come from that, or the transparency on what happens in commodity, transparency simply helps.
And do you think that traders then, because some of our traders, big of our listeners, are traders, right? And then Martijn, I mean, also looking at you, less transparency, right? Instead of more transparency. Or could you say that, you know, the biggest commodities like, you know, crude oil is super transparent, right? And still there are margins made, there's volatility, so it's good for traders, I assume, to play in. So is transparency a good or a bad thing actually for traders, right? So I see that transparency is very good for producers and buyers. Is it also good for traders?
I think most traders, they like to be able to trade proprietary information. So and proprietary information is access to what is happening in origin and destination countries, but also the ability to properly analyze that, to connect the dots. and to do that timely and being able to position yourself accordingly. So yeah, I think that for producers and consumers, transparency is better because at the end of the day, their business model is not to trade these things. Their business model is as Willem says, is make products that the customer wants, do fantastic marketing to have a value proposition, and then to have an ability to have stability on the raw material side and make a margin. But traders, they need movement in prices in order to make money. And traders who process commodities, they are actually equipped to trade around the assets. But those assets, the margins on those assets are way less than, for example, in Unilever, when you make money on flavors. So, you know, the beauty business of Unilever, if you look at the margins made on that, because it's a consumer product, are way higher than running a chocolate factory or a cocoa factory or an oilseed factory. It's high volume, low margin. And therefore, the margin sits more in what we call merchandising, is trading around the capacity and correctly anticipating the margin cycle, because the margin cycle is volatile as well. And that's the difference, right? You need the movement. And for Willem and his team is, it's nicer if raw material prices are stable and fairly predictable, and the organization can focus on the value proposition and marketing and these things. Yeah. So, no, it's an interesting discussion, of course. And I think if you compare it to years ago, there has been much more transparency already than in the past. Huh? You know, the internet has made, and other technology has made access to markets and origins, mm-hmm. Much, much, much easier than in the past. What I'm also thinking about is the audience, they love personal stories and they love personal experiences. You have had a fantastic career in Unilever. Could you share with our audience some of the defining moments in your career? And when you think about some highlights where you felt like, well, you know, this is just amazing to experience that, or maybe extremely challenging, but some stuff that you now look back at and think, well, yeah, that was a moment of personal growth that, you know, had a real big impact on my professional career, but also personally, things that really were important to you in your long, successful career.
Yeah, great question, Martijn. So one of these for me has been, I started my career, was born in the Netherlands. So I started my career with Unilever in Vlaardingen. And looked for an opportunity to work outside of the Netherlands for some time. And I finally found a job in Mexico. I was planning to do that for about 2 years, but finally stayed for 12 years in Mexico. I do remember that when I started to work in Mexico, a few years out of university, still very much a bit with that Dutch type of mindset, as you come out of university and then trying to work in Mexico, I quickly discovered that that really wasn't effective. I remember that I would arrive in meetings, for example, 5 minutes before time. You know that in the Netherlands you would do that and everybody would be there and you would catch up for 5 minutes and then straight at the hour you would start your meeting. Here it would be that my team would come in 10 minutes after the hour and then start talking about some things, and the final people would be 15 minutes after or whatever it would be. And I remember actually getting quite annoyed with that, no? And finally discovered that, well, the only one who really gets annoyed with this is me. I would need to adopt. Anyway, small example there. But I think I loved Mexico, to work there, the people, the business that we had, country, the culture, all fantastic. But it took quite some adaptation to get to like it. I think that for me personally, the ability to adapt is, and it doesn't matter if this goes for a different country, but for the situation that you're in, really helps to become a lot more effective. And that's something, I think, for every situation that you're in, something at least to keep in your back of your mind for, is this something where, you know, it would just help if I adapt a bit more, and can I do that? That's definitely what Mexico, one of the things I have to say that Mexico taught me. I think as well, some of the work that I've done in factories, for example, I did, you spoke about margarines before, Martijn. So I was a production manager for a margarine factory. And we had a refinery there as well, liquid oil refinery for bean oil, rapeseed.
Yeah.
And that refinery was something that at that point in time, it was being looked at for what do we do with those refineries? Because Unilever has sold the majority of its refineries. We still have that refinery there. This was also in Mexico. The ability that the people of that refinery had to make that performance better, really much better, with just a bit better understanding of why that's important to the business and what is the freedom that they have to work through those proposals, to make those kind of improvements, it really brought out miracles in the performance of that refinery that we had. And then finally, we didn't sell it for a very long time. There, for me, the lesson has been very much about what the effects can be of empowerment of people. So I really think that anybody who works in any organization, in the end, you know, the majority of people, the large majority, if not almost all, are working there to actually make that organization better. And they know as well what needs to be done in the jobs, many times better than the managers or the leaders that they work with. You do need to have the empowerment to be able to experiment, to try something new and get to very different outcomes. If you don't have that, then it's very difficult to make these step changes in performance. So for me, that leadership with empowerment of people is, for me, extremely important to see some disproportionate changes and results coming through. I love that in all of the jobs that I've done since. Yeah, and another, I was in India during the time that during the time of COVID. I started actually in that job in September, what was it, 2019. Hmm. Country went in lockdown in March of the next year, which was a hard lockdown. I remember on the, what is it, the 24th of March, I was listening to the radio in the evening where President Modi came on and saying that the country went into hard lockdown starting at 12 o'clock that night. The next morning, we had all of our factories shut down. And people were looking, of course, at that time for and soaps. No, especially in the time of COVID, and hand sanitizers and many of the products that we had there. What we did to get our operations back and running is that the main thing that we cared about is the safety of our people. So the medical services that we put in place, the testing that we had there, the operating procedures that we had in our factories to really make sure that people could work in a separated environment. Well, too much to go into, but we had the management team really going after caring for people. And the thinking there was very much, if we make sure that we care for our people take care of our business. And that worked extremely well as well. If the enthusiasm that was there and the willingness of people to make sure that the products that our consumers or the country at that point in time needed most, and the drive for that was amazing to see. But it required a very different type of leadership than you would normally have for running a supply chain.
Well, wow, that's great stories. Really, really impressive. Nice.
That's a really cool one, huh?
Some questions that we always ask is, who do you admire in business? Can be in Unilever, can be outside. And what types of what books or book do you recommend? There's lots of questions from people who are interested in, you know, after university going into, you know, deciding what kind of industry they're going to work in, and especially also in the commodities industry. Are there any books that you recommend, and which people do you really admire?
Yeah. You already mentioned that I got 25 years in the company, so then you can guess something about my age as well, which means from the time that I started working more in the leadership roles in business, I thought one of the greatest examples that was there was Jack Welch. And I still believe that it's one of the great examples in industry. But if I take it more recent, now you mentioned, you asked about books, no? Or what I find the greatest books. If I think of the ones for a little bit more business related, but the ones that I read longer back, but I really love that. There's a book on Guns, Germs, and Steel. This is from Jared Diamond. It's an older book, actually, because it's from, the late 90s. But it's still a book that, to me, something in my mind of how the world is for what the world is today helps me quite a bit in my thinking. So, but if I take it more recent, what is it, in a couple of years ago, there was a book published by, this was Caroline Paris. She had a book called Invisible Women. This is about the biases that are there in industry, in the way that we actually look at data and take decisions over data, and how that is still very biased towards men. I found that particularly interesting because quite analytical myself, so I do trust a lot in data, but that book really opens your mind as well, that you have to be careful what kind of data you're looking at. Now, and then something that I'm reading now, there's a book that's called 10 to 25, which is from David Yeager. It's about motivating young people. And I think for me in particular right now with the job that I'm in, I do remember when I started my career and I looked at the people that had the jobs that I have today and that had many years in the company. I do remember that thinking of that connect that was there between the different generations or younger generation that I was at that point in time and the older generations that sat in the jobs that I'm doing today made me think then that if I ever get there, I try to do that better. So that's a book to read if you want to give that some thought.
That's an interesting topic.
That's a really good one. I like the one, The Guns, Gems, and Steel. I already wrote it down. That sounds like a good one on the history of everybody. Looking at the time, we're coming to the end here, gentlemen. I don't know if there's a last remark or question, but otherwise we're going to go to the end. And thank you, Willem, for a fantastic podcast. And I really enjoyed how you look at, from your point of view, in an FMCG company towards the market there where we have been in for many, many years, some of our listeners as well. I think that's really interesting because a lot of our, you know, supplying you with one or other commodity. So I think it's always great to hear that. Then you hear the leader who's buying, all the people who is buying all that product. I think it's interesting to hear their thoughts. So that will be interesting to also listen to the reactions that we will get. And that you want to keep yourself young to all your colleagues that you have. I think that's a perfect one. But you look very strong and young and vibrant still. So thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, I also want to express my gratitude that we can talk to you. I mean, talk to the C-suite of Unilever is obviously very special. And what you did was just giving an honest and open and transparent overview of the job that you do and the challenges that you face. I learned a lot. So that's just very nice. So thanks a lot. You know, we and our audience are very happy to have you. Great. Thank you.
Great. It's great to hear. Well, thank you very much, Martijn, Alex. Great to talk with you. And I'll see you soon. Yeah. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.